Coming up on Tech News Weekly, it's us, not just Micah, but I'm back. So I'm happy to be here along with Micah. We talk first with Dan Ackerman from CNET. He gives us the lowdown on the new MacBook Air M2. He has a review, talks all about it. Then we're joined by Richard Lawler from The Verge. Netflix, you may have heard, getting ads at some point, and now we know Microsoft is the partner for those ads. Richard talks all about that. Also, how TikTok is emerging as a headache for YouTube. Yes, we saw that coming, but also Google search? Apparently so. And finally, we picked apart the Uber files, and let's just say we weren't that surprised by what we read and found out. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Weekly.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 243, recorded Thursday, July 14th, 2022. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by SecureWorks. Are you ready for inevitable cyber threats? SecureWorks detects ever-changing threats and defends against them with a combination of security analytics and human intelligence. To learn more, visit SecureWorks.com.
And by Drata, security professionals are undergoing the tedious and arduous task of manually collecting evidence. With Drata, say goodbye to the days of manual evidence collection and hello to automation. All done at Drata speed. Visit Drata.com/twit to get a demo and 10% off implementation.
And by ClickUp, the productivity platform that'll save you one day a week on work, guaranteed. Use code TNW to get 15% off ClickUp's massive unlimited plan for a year, meaning you can start reclaiming your time for under $5 a month. Sign up today at ClickUp.com. Hurry, this offer ends soon.
Hello and welcome to Tech News Weekly, the show where every week we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. And I can actually say we this
we
weekend
finally.
Mean it. We again. Yes, I am one of your hosts, Micah Sargent.
And I'm the other guy, Jason Howell. Thank you so much, Micah, for doing not one but 2 weeks without me. I know it. And last week it was four interviews. I know what that's like. That's a lot of juggling. So I appreciate
a lot of chatter, but it was a good time. But I am glad that you are back and so excited. You know that your vacay went well and all of that jazz. So welcome back.
Thank you, Jason. Feels good to be back. All right, so let's get started. And Micah will probably be talking about a topic that's close, you know, near and dear to your heart: the MacBook Air. This is the latest MacBook Air with the M2 chip inside, and sure enough, today. Apparently, reviews embargoes have lifted because a bunch of reviews hit the web. And there are a lot of improvements that have hit the MacBook Air M2 model. So we thought that Dan Ackerman from CNET could join us to talk all about those changes. In fact, Dan, you called this the biggest change to the airline since its launch. Not the airlines, of course, like planes, but the MacBook Air line. So I'm excited to hear your take. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Thanks. It's good to be here. I also have a lot of thoughts about airlines. We can certainly talk about that, too.
Sure. Maybe we'll get to that later. But for right now, we're going to stick with Apple. Before getting into the review content itself, talk a little bit about like what has made the MacBook Air so unique, this family of devices in Apple's catalog of premium laptops.
You know, it's interesting. A couple of years ago, I think it was 2018, I went back because it was the 10th anniversary of the MacBook Air. And I said, I got to remind myself where this line came from, where it started out. So I went back to the very first review of the first MacBook Air from 2008. I said, oh, let me read this review. Who wrote this review? It turns out it was me. I had no memory of it
whatsoever.
Don't you love that? That's how long I've been doing this.
Yeah.
And that MacBook Air, even though we all loved kind of the slim shape and the idea behind it, it was $1,800. It had one USB port on it. And if you wanted a solid state hard drive instead of a platter drive, that was an extra $1,000 on top of that. Now, like that, the MacBook Air would not be something we'd hear about today. But after a few years, they said, you know what? Let's just make this a $1,000 laptop, $999, great for college students, you know, people just starting out, creative people who just want to sit at a coffee shop and write a novel, or just general, you need a general knock-around computer. $1,000, you're sorted. You don't have to think about it. And that's why I think the MacBook Air has been so popular over the years and why I call it, for most generations, not every, but most, I call it the most universally useful computer you can buy.
Right on. And I mean, incredibly popular. I mean, I feel like you see MacBook Airs everywhere, and that's probably because of kind of the lower price category. I kind of always like steered away personally from the MacBook Air because I'm like, oh, I want performance and everything. But now we're kind of getting into this weird territory where Apple's, you know, putting its best chips in all of its laptops. So, you know, the differences between them are a lot more narrowed, let's say. Tell us a little bit about the configuration that you tested specifically.
Now, it's interesting because this moves from Apple's M1 chip, which was its first post-Intel chip, to the M2. And you go, oh, so M1 is the first version, M2, much better. It's actually a little more complicated than that. In the middle, they had the M1 Pro and the M1 Max and the M1 Ultra that went in different MacBook Pro and Mac Studio systems. So the M2 is actually only the second one in the lineup. It's the M1 is down here, M2, and then M1 Pro, Max, Ultra. So the naming stuff is a little confusing, as it often is. That said, M2 is a little bit faster than M1. M1 was a good deal faster than the Intel version ever placed, and all of them are fine for everyday computer stuff. I do Photoshop stuff on M1s and M2s. I've done 4K video editing on them. Generally, unless you're going like super high-end or you're a real creative professional, then you should look at something with an M1 Pro or Max chip, which will take you into the MacBook Pro line. But I've said, I mean, going back many years, that people often, maybe not you, Jason, because you're a high-end professional, but a lot of people, literally, they buy too much computer. You don't need it. What are you, surfing the web, email?
Yeah.
Even Photoshop is going web-based now. And I tried out the web-based Photoshop. It's great.
Yeah, yeah. No, and thank you for calling me a professional. I do appreciate it. your colleague, Lori Grunin, compared the M2 to the previous M1 series, kind of what you're talking about. Based on what Lori spelled out in her piece, kind of comparing the performance here, I think what I'm interested here in is kind of touches on what she wrote and also what you're talking about here, which is that, you know, in the past, I feel like the MacBook Air hasn't been maybe the right choice for someone who's even doing basic kind of media editing and stuff like that. Like, yeah, it could work, but you'd really be better served kind of bumping up. But now with these new chips and the performance increases that we're seeing in the M1 and the M2 chips, and specifically here, obviously the M2, like, do you think this is a solution for you know, like a basic YouTuber or something like that?
And these numbers you're seeing are all based on the labs testing we're doing at the CNET labs, because we still do all our own benchmarking, super important to us. And yeah, what we've established is if you're looking at 13-inch laptops, the MacBook Air and the MacBook Pro, the 13-inch Pro, the difference delta between them in terms of performance is very, very small. They actually both use the M2 chip now. And if you're going beyond a certain number of streams of, you know, 4K or 8K video, sure, then you want to trade up. And the delta between the M2 and the M1, even Pro, the next step up, is pretty big. But so is the price difference. For $1,200, you can do really well with this, and I would be very happy doing YouTube, doing basic video editing, doing even high-end photo editing. And another thing that you get now that kind of held the Air back before is you get the 500 nit, the brighter screen that the Pros have had. So now you have a better screen as well. And this one is even a little bit bigger. It's one of those little secret upgrades. It's not 13.3 inches, it's 13.6. It's not the biggest difference in the world, but to people like you and me who maybe have to turn the Google Docs up to 125% these days, you know, every little bit helps.
Hey, what are you saying? What are you saying? I'm getting older? That's true. I am getting
I'm
older.
Saying this is my, I think I'm about the trifocals now. That's what I'm saying.
All right. Otherwise, the design language has kind of changed. This is no longer Wedge. Is that right?
This is the first time since that 2008 launch that it's not a wedge. It's the same kind of flat, I call it a very constructivist look, you know, free of any kind of ornamentation that the 14 and 16 inch Pros have, and the Mac Studio also. Here, look, if I lift it up like this, see, look at that, totally flat. Mm-hmm. If you put it back to back with a wedge MacBook Air, it's a little bit narrower at the back, and the footprint is, it's really 99.9% the same, but it feels thinner and it's a hair lighter. But I think it's much more sleek looking like this.
Yeah, that's a slick looking device. I like it. How about the higher res webcam? We were talking before the show that you're not using. Obviously, you were just showing us the Air, so you're obviously not using that to do your video for this interview, but you are using basically the same webcam. What was your experience with the camera on this device?
Yeah, I'm using the 1080 camera in the 24-inch iMac, which is essentially the same as a 1080 camera now in the 14-inch Pro, 16-inch Pro, and now this 13-inch Air, not in the new 13-inch Pro. That still has the old 720 camera. And listen, we all know that MacBook webcams have always kind of sucked. Everybody's always said that. And now that we're doing all these, you know, web meetings and Zoom meetings and video stuff, it's more important now than ever. And frankly, 2 years too late, there's finally a 1080 camera in a MacBook Air. And it's not just the resolution, it's the image processing too. We did some side-by-side still shots and video, and you can see those on our CNET review, and you can really tell the difference. And again, not just resolution, the image processing is much smarter behind it. And it's really caught up with a lot of Windows systems, where premium Windows systems have moved to 1080 cameras over the last few years.
Right on. And then also want to talk a little bit about MagSafe, because personally, I've always been a big fan of MagSafe. I was definitely bummed when they got rid of it. And then it's come back. And I very recently, like within the last month, bought the MacBook Pro, last year's model of the MacBook Pro that does have the MagSafe, has the M1 chip. And I really appreciate having MagSafe back. You mentioned in your article that you're kind of like, you know what? I think I'm over it. Like the USB-C is just fine. Tell us a little bit about that, because I, as much as I'm happy having MagSafe back, it's not as critical to me either, because I, you know, like you say, you can just plug it right into that USB-C and it's not a big deal.
You got options. You know, I love MagSafe originally. I was sad when it went away, largely because I'm very clumsy. But then something interesting happened. Apple did something the company does not often do. It added a universal standard to its products and said, oh, USB-C, that's your data connection, your accessory connection, your power connection, and half the phones out there and almost all the Windows laptops out there and your Nintendo Switch and your Steam Deck and everything else all decided to use USB-C. I'm like, I can't believe we're living in this. Is this real? Am I living in a simulation? This is amazing. So what does Apple do immediately? They go, you know what? We're bringing back a proprietary cable. Let's do that. So they eat up a bunch of space on the side over here for the MagSafe connection. You still got USB-C and you can still use that. If you want to use this, it's a perfectly nice cable. And on the MacBook, it's color-coded. The cable matches. Like, this is midnight, which I think is the coolest color. And the cable for the MagSafe is also midnight. But am I going to carry around one proprietary cable with me? Or am I just going to throw a generic USB-C cable from, like, Adele or something in my bag? Or just assume that everywhere I go, somebody is going to have a USB-C plug? That's what I'm going to do.
Yeah, and along those lines, kind of with the option, like, now that I'm thinking about it, you know, at my home setup, I have like my music production studio and it kind of goes into place and I can have it plugged into MagSafe there. But then when I'm going anywhere, you're right. In my bag, I'm going to have a USB-C if I'm going to have anything. And that's just fine. Plug it into the MagSafe. Then if I knock it off the studio table, hey, whatever. But it's less of a necessity now than I feel like it. Well, then it felt like it was back in the first version of MagSafe to me. So.
I mean, especially because everyone had proprietary laptop cables back then.
Totally.
Brand A didn't work with Brand B. Now it's so universal. And even Apple was on board for a while. And I was pleasantly surprised by that until they said, oh, wait, we can sell you a special cable again. Why are we not doing that?
Well, at least you have options. At least you have both of them. And then price-wise, entry cost for this laptop is definitely up. How do you feel about how does that sit with you?
This is my biggest disappointment about the system. They brought back what I call my least favorite feature about the MacBook Air, the feature being they occasionally make it more expensive than $999. I think back in maybe 2018, they bumped it up by $200, and I said, that's a terrible idea. And then a year or two later, they brought it back down to $999, where it stayed ever since. So now we're back up to $1,200. As I saw, they're keeping the M1 version, the wedge version from 2020, and you're buying 2020 hardware if you're doing this, they're keeping that at $999. So Apple can say, we sell a $1,000 computer, but you're going to feel kind of left out if you get that MacBook Air and then somebody else next to you has this MacBook Air mm-hmm. with the new screen and the new camera and the new features and the M2 chip instead of the M1
the
chip.
Colors, yeah.
I feel like, you know, hopefully in a year or two, this one will go back down to $999. I think it's an important psychological barrier and frankly, a practical barrier. If you're a college student, if you're just starting out, if you're just going to sit in a coffee shop and write your novel all day, $999 is achievable. You can work your way up to that. $1,200, then you got to reconsider.
I absolutely agree. I think a psychological barrier, that's exactly what it is. And I have to imagine at some point that ends up dropping down again. So, but that's just a guess, and we will see. And when that happens, perhaps Dan Ackerman will write all about it like he has this awesome review at CNET. Dan, it's always a pleasure getting to talk with you. Thank you for hopping on with us. If people want to follow your work online, where can they find you?
You can find me all over CNET and on Twitter at Dan Ackerman. Thanks, man.
Right on. Thank you, too. Take care of yourself. Be safe and stay healthy this summer. We'll talk to you soon.
Will do. See ya.
Bye, Dan. All right. Up next, Netflix is on pace to get ads. I'm sure you've heard about this. And now apparently Microsoft is the company that's going to help them do it. So we're going to talk all about that. That's Micah's interview coming up next. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by SecureWorks. SecureWorks is actually a subsidiary of Dell. What would happen if an intruder broke into your home and then moved in without you knowing it, sneaking around, eating your food, using your Netflix account with or without ads? Imagine an intruder doing that same thing to your IT infrastructure. You know, how many passwords would they actually be able to compromise? How many systems could they damage or degrade? How many pieces of personal or maybe even financial data could they steal? Threat actors often are hiding in plain sight in IT systems. That's what makes them so difficult to find, for more than 200 days on average, in fact, before they're detected. What happens when stopping at the endpoint is stopping your ability to properly defend your infrastructure? Well, enter SecureWorks Taegis Extended Detection and Response. That's XDR. It actually enables a more comprehensive and effective security posture than ever before. One unified, singular point of view providing unparalleled visibility. It's also extensible, following data moving beyond the perimeter, helping organizations unify their prevention, their detection, and their response. And it mitigates the issue of siloed security solutions that leave coverage gaps for the adversary to leverage. By organizing multiple point solutions and creating one unified and clear picture of your infrastructure, Taegis XDR can actually help teams prevent threats effectively, also detect them rapidly, and then finally respond appropriately. SecureWorks meets customers where they are with managed XDR. You're going to get a SaaS solution that can leverage the SecureWorks experts 24/7, 365. And that's to investigate and to respond to the threats on your behalf so you can cut down dwell times, decrease your operational burden, and reduce all of the associated costs. Some customers obviously have a large security team and can manage XDR by themselves with minimal contact with their experts. But in most cases, companies have a shortage of security talent and actually need their help to manage and monitor any potential threats to their environment. SecureWorks provides fast emergency response with chat, and that includes incident commanders who are actually going to find the root cause while preparing you for future threats. When your organization actually experiences a breach or maybe even a cyber attack, there's no time to spare. As you know, the quicker you get to this, the more you can lessen the damage that it causes. If this happens, you call 1-800-BREACHED, and SecureWorks emergency incident response team can actually provide you immediate assistance responding to and remediating a possible cyber incident or a data breach 24/7, whatever time of day it happens to be. SecureWorks offers a purpose-built XDR solution that's designed to answer today's evolving security challenges. It's optimized by machine learning and deep detection capabilities, but also refined through human intelligence and insights earned over decades of experience. All that experience working in your favor. A Gartner, Forrester, and IDC leader in security operations, SecureWorks actually empowers organizations with a collaborative and innovative security solution that requires to achieve strong security in an evolving digital world. So at SecureWorks.com, that's what you want to remember, SecureWorks.com, you can actually learn more about the ways today's threat environment is evolving and the risks it can present to your organization, including case studies you'll find there, reports from their counter threat unit, and a whole lot more. Visit SecureWorks.com. SecureWorks, be the threat, beat the threat. We thank SecureWorks for their support of Tech News Weekly. All right, Micah, over to you.
All right. Yes, some
pretty new news, as it were, related to Netflix, who we've heard for some time is has been thinking about introducing a new tier to its service. Joining us today to talk about Netflix's partnership with Microsoft is The Verge's Richard Lawler. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, happy to have you here. So let's kick things off. We've been hearing about an ad-supported tier on Netflix for quite a while now, and I'm curious, can you just give us the basic details of this news and Microsoft's involvement in it?
Certainly. I think where we can start is really kind of the rough start to the year that Netflix has been having. Like many companies, as the pandemic has progressed and people were at home, Netflix's growth accelerated sharply, well beyond their, you know, their previous predictions as more people subscribed. And they kind of had a spike. And as people started going back outside, that spike went down. We've seen it with other companies. It hit Netflix very hard. They, for the first time in about 10 years, they've reported that they had lost subscribers in total, that they were actually having a shrinking subscriber base. And for Netflix, trying to find ways to make more money when you have more than 100 million customers is a bit difficult. How you get more people, how you can make more money from the customers that you have. And something that they've been very against in streaming for years now and have openly said that they did not like and did not want to do was to add advertising. But circumstances have changed. The investors are a little uneasy. And suddenly the executives are open to advertising. And we've heard that they've told employees that we could see advertising launch on Netflix by the end of this year. So Netflix is open and ready to launch advertising, but they don't really have any expertise or any way to do that. They have so much expertise in keeping streaming running. They have a service that, you know, almost never goes down and streams video all over the world, but they don't have advertising. So they had to go find someone to kind of help out with that. And that's where Microsoft steps in.
Yeah, that was actually
to really provide the technology and ways to get it done.
Yeah, I mean, because I was kind of curious about this, why Netflix chose to partner with Microsoft. When I think of advertising, and, you know, I've got only a base understanding of it, I typically think of Google, I think of Facebook, I think of maybe even Amazon, who, if you don't have ad blockers, has lots of different ads that they serve on their own site. Those are the big advertisers that I think of. Is Microsoft there and doing this, and I'm just not as aware of it, but also, is this an opportunity for Microsoft to take a step forward? Is this kind of a big bit of business, both for Netflix, but also for Microsoft?
I think that the second point is true, is that it is an opportunity for Microsoft really to raise this profile in the advertising business. As you mentioned, obviously Google, Facebook are the huge names in advertising, but Microsoft is also there. They have Bing, which we may joke about, but it exists. It has advertising, and they've been building up some of their more creative elements within even products like Windows that may help support and work with a more robust advertising business. There are also rumors that they are considering an ad-supported or in ways to integrate ads for free-to-play games on Xbox, which is a massive opportunity for them. So they've also been building that up. And there was a report by the Wall Street Journal, Sarah Krauss wrote, that one of the major elements for Netflix choosing Microsoft is they considered partnering with Comcast, who has an ad business of its own with NBC Universal that it uses to deliver ads both on cable and online, and also considered Google. However, both of those companies compete with Netflix when it comes to video. So they're obviously Netflix has in its entire history been very secretive and very cautious about sharing data. And that's one of their big things as a company. So I can see why they may not want to partner with either of those two parties. And so Microsoft has the advantage of being agnostic in that particular way. And they also purchased a company that most of us have never heard of at the end of last year called Xandr. As AT&T sold off Time Warner and HBO and all of its kind of other media properties, something that went slightly less noticed was that they also sold this company that they had acquired, this startup for this advertising ad tech startup called Xandr. And that company is focused on building ads for a post-cookie world. Like many other companies, is trying to figure out how to kind of target people without violating their privacy, without using cookies, which, you know, Google and other browsers are starting to phase out, and you won't be able to use to be able to find your audience anymore, and find a way to make that work. And Microsoft has it; they have the technology, and they're ready to deliver.
Ah, okay, that makes sense. I think perhaps if Microsoft had gone through and purchased TikTok, like was rumored, then maybe this would be a different conversation, because then they would be competing a little bit more directly with Netflix in the video space. But that didn't happen, so now this is starting to make sense. It's starting to really add up. This, of course, I know is kind of in the rumor space. The press releases don't directly talk about this, but do you have any details? Do we know any details? Do we know any rumors about pricing for the ad-supported tier? Because I think some people might think of the Spotify model where you can stream Spotify music for free and ads occasionally play on the platform. This is not going to be that as far as we know, right? You're not going to be able to just turn on the Netflix channel and it just streams through for free without any without having to pay anything as long as you have the ads going. This will be maybe a sort of subsidized model like other streaming video services.
That's what it sounds like. It sounds more like Netflix is preparing to go the subsidized model where you get a slightly lower price in exchange for seeing some amount of ads. Exactly what those prices will be, we haven't heard a bunch of reliable information yet. That same Wall Street Journal report suggested that one of the plans that they're considering, and Netflix is kind of moving very quickly with all of this, so I'm sure things are flexible at the moment, but one thing that they may be considering is to have lower priced versions of each of the three tiers that they offer. They have like standard def, high def, and an option with 4K and multiple streams at different price points, and to have cheaper versions of each of those if you agree to see some advertising. Also, something that we've seen Netflix do over the last couple of years is to occasionally have some free content available. They've occasionally done sort of like free weekends or had like mini sites with certain Netflix originals to try and attract people. And if Netflix becomes a more traditional TV video provider, I wouldn't be surprised to see them do more of that. It's not something they've done so far, but they will be less unique if they're in a space where they have advertisements, and they really need to increase eyeballs on that.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the announcement, Netflix said Microsoft will be its, quote, global advertising technology and sales partner, unquote. And I'm curious about kind of, does that mean that Microsoft is basically, and you touched on this a little bit earlier, Microsoft is coming in and kind of handling all of it? They're the ones that are going to go out and find the advertisers who are going to advertise on the platform. They're the ones who are going to sort of connect their technology. It sounds like Netflix is kind of just buying it's like the equivalent of hiring someone to come in and fix your house. You know, you don't do anything with them. They just come in. You say, oh, I want to have this done. They come in, they put in the pool and handle all of the concrete pouring and all of that stuff. Is that kind of what's going on here? Netflix is like, look, that's not our thing. You do that part. We just want to have the money that gets subsidized so that we can offer these subscriptions.
That's really what it sounds like, that Netflix is focusing on what they do well, or what they feel like they do well, which is to create this content, to create the service, and to deliver it. And that the advertising, that is kind of outside their area. And at least at the start, that they'll be able to let someone else do that. We've seen this, they've kind of moved into other industries as Netflix has started to produce its own shows. If you go back to when they first rolled out streaming apps, they did a lot of relying on other people. And I'm not surprised to see them kind of follow that same strategy in this space.
Mm-hmm. And then I was curious, there was a brief mention of privacy in Microsoft's announcement. And you did touch on this a little bit as well, where we are getting to a post-cookie world. Does that mean that we won't see, you know, I'm watching, I don't know, the Stranger Things season 7 that we're, you know, eventually on. And during it, then it shows me an ad for my favorite trail mix that I get at the local grocery store that I use Instacart to order from. So they've got that information. It sounds like it's not going to be that targeted. From what we know, is this more of an idea of people who watch this kind of content would probably like these kinds of things versus this hyper-targeted bit of advertising that is directed at me individually? How do we know anything about the ad tech based on, like you said, Microsoft's acquisitions and kind of what these streaming services have done in the past?
We haven't seen really enough of it to say exactly what they're going to be doing, but that sounds like the direction, especially that companies like Google are going with the privacy sandbox and the different kind of experiments that they've proposed, where they track more, as you said, people like you, and try to kind of target that way within the groups. And it's something that all of these companies are doing. When you take a look at companies like Roku or Vizio, something that people may not realize is that while Vizio appears to be a TV company, over the last couple of years, they've made far more money from their services and advertising business. Roku is also like that, where that's really where they make their money, is by selling by categorizing this information and then selling ads against it. So Netflix and Microsoft, they could have a significantly more privacy-protecting operation, but still makes a lot of money potentially from advertisements if they have the data and are able to use it properly. So I think that's the promise that a company like Xandr has had. But one of the reasons why you haven't heard of them is because it's been more of a promise. We haven't exactly seen it all in operation yet.
Right. And then last but not least, I'm curious, outside of an ad-supported tier, obviously Netflix is trying to do what it can to increase subscription, increase daily active users, and make sure that its platform continues to be viable as its investors see it. What is Netflix doing outside of this? What are the rumors of other ways that Netflix is looking at trying to sort of increase its business outside of an ad-supported tier?
Well, Netflix is in an area, and the environment in streaming video has changed from when it first launched and kind of had this the entire segment to itself. There was no one else doing subscription streaming. Now the studios that make the content that Netflix used to buy from them all have subscription streaming services of their own. So getting the content that people want to watch is harder. It's more expensive. They have to pay to produce it in many cases. Two things that they've tried to implement just recently are video games. Is something that Netflix is getting big into. They haven't started charging more for it. And right now they kind of just have mobile games on iOS and Android for people to play built in with their Netflix subscription. But it is something that they've invested significantly in. They've acquired some studios, and they're creeping into that. And I do wonder how that will make them a competitor for Microsoft, where they have Xbox, they have xCloud, they have cloud gaming streaming. So they may bump heads a bit there. But it's still so early that those things aren't really the same. But that is something that they are looking at to expand their offerings. And also something that executives called out specifically when the subscriber drop came out is password sharing and how Netflix will handle that and what they will do. They have tested a few approaches in other countries, not in the U.S. yet, where they prompt people who they believe are sharing their passwords and kind of try to poke them to sign up for an extra fee to get more simultaneous streams, for example, on their account. And how successful that is, if they're able to do that without upsetting customers and losing even more subscribers, or to be able to kind of get more money out of the subscribers they have and convince people who maybe right now are using their cousin or old ex's account to get an account of their own. Maybe that's an opportunity there, but those are two specific areas they're focusing on. And it's one of the reasons they need to is because they've recently raised the price over the last several years. They've repeatedly raised prices. I'm sure if you have Netflix, you've noticed you're paying quite a bit more than you used to. And I know for me, it got to the point where subscribing to Netflix isn't automatic anymore because it costs so much.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a struggle that they're facing.
I'm right there with you on that. It's one of those things where I've never in the past sort of taken the time to examine what shows do I watch here, how much do I watch, and is it worth keeping. Now I do have that moment of like, this could be one that I kick. And I've never had that before with Netflix, so it's kind of wild. Richard, I want to thank you so much for joining us today to talk about this. Of course, folks can head over to The Verge to check out your work, but if they'd like to follow you online, is there a place they can go to do that?
On Twitter, at RJCC is where you can follow me for kind of tech news, mediocre Apex Legends clips. I do all things.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Alrighty, folks. Up next, YouTube loses ground to another social video platform. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Drata.
Is your organization finding it difficult to achieve continuous compliance as it quickly grows and scales? Not a surprise. I mean, you're getting bigger and you are doing all the things. And so maybe you're struggling to make sure that those compliance needs are met. Is manual evidence collection slowing your team down? As G2's highest rated cloud compliance software, Drata streamlines your SOC 2, your ISO 27001, your PCI DSS, your GDPR, your HIPAA, and other compliance frameworks, and provides 24-hour continuous control monitoring so you focus on scaling securely. It's funny, I think of the people out there who are listening to this who are going, that one, that one, that one, that one. It's all alphabet soup to me, but I'm glad that Drata has those covered. With a suite of 75 plus integrations, Drata easily integrates with your tech stack through applications such as AWS, Azure, GitHub, Okta, and Cloudflare. Countless security professionals from companies including Lemonade, Notion, oh, I love Notion, and Bamboo HR have shared how crucial it has been to have Drata as a trusted partner in the compliance process. Their deep native integrations provide instant visibility into a security program and continuous monitoring to ensure compliance is always met. Drata allows companies to see all of their controls and easily map them to compliance frameworks to gain immediate insight into framework overlap. Companies can start building a solid security posture from day one with Drata, achieve and maintain compliance as your business scales, and expand their security assurance efforts using the Drata platform. Drata's automated dynamic policy templates support companies new to compliance and help alleviate hours of manual labor. Their integrated security awareness training program and automated reminders ensure smooth employee onboarding, and they are the only player in the industry to build on a private database architecture from day one, meaning your data can never be accessed by anyone outside your organization. All customers receive a team of compliance experts. This is super cool, including a designated customer success manager. In addition, they've got a team of former auditors who have conducted 500 plus audits and are available for support and counsel. Your success is their success. With a consistent meeting cadence, they keep you on track and ensure that there are no surprises, no barriers. Plus, your pre-audit calls ensure you are set up for success when your audits begin. Drata is personally backed by SVCI, a syndicate of CISO angel investors from some of the world's most influential companies. Say goodbye to manual evidence collection and hello to automated compliance by visiting drata.com/twit. That's drata.com/twit. Bringing automation to compliance at Drata speed. Thank you, Drata, for sponsoring this week's episode of Tech News Weekly. It's time for Jason Howell's Story of the Week.
All right, let's do it. So time marches on, as we know, in the world of technology. And one thing that we've seen before, but I feel like we've seen this especially with Facebook in the last couple of years, let's say, and maybe even in the last year, is that as much as we think things are going to stay the same, things shift dramatically at certain times. And so these players like Facebook, for example, end up, like, I feel like the conversation around Facebook has changed a lot in the past year or two. There have been a lot of reasons why that's happened. But Facebook used to be this, you know, billions of users platform that no one will ever beat, right? And sure, they still have an insane amount of users, but like the younger users aren't really going to Facebook anymore. And so that's changing the balance and the landscape of, you know, who's kind of the up and coming, who's the potential next Facebook, that sort of thing. Well, and then you've got Google, right? And Google has been, you know, at the top of the heap in search and so many other things. You know, they're a constant in what they do in technology. But now we're hearing a lot about TikTok, right? And that's, and when I think of TikTok, I think of like this little I think of a video platform, maybe with little videos on it because they're shorter videos. But I think of it as just a video platform. And it turns out that the younger generations are actually thinking of TikTok as something more. And I've got a couple of stories that kind of allude to this. And I just thought it was kind of interesting. So we can kind of summarize these here real quick. So first of all, TechCrunch helped conduct a study of 400,000 families with, I think it's called Q Studio software. It's basically software running on the devices for parental monitoring, for monitoring how some of its younger users are actually using their devices, what they're using, how long they're using it, that sort of stuff. They tracked real-world usage, so this is not estimates. This is actually tracking how it was used ongoing. So that's 400,000 families, quite a big sample set. And the data seems to show that Gen Z and Gen Alpha, by the way, is all kids born after 2010. So think of like the COVID, the pandemic generation, essentially, are turning even more away from YouTube, which has just been so dominant when it comes to online video, and toward TikTok. During the pandemic, that data actually showed TikTok at 75 minutes per day, right? TikTok was ahead of YouTube, 75 minutes per day on average compared to YouTube's 64 minutes. But now in the past year, in this update to this report, TikTok has now jumped up to 91 minutes on average. YouTube saw 56 minutes. So YouTube declining, TikTok soaring. Tip-top. Is that what all the kids are using these days? Tip-top? Since 2019, YouTube has actually declined. TikTok is growing, and not just by a little as far as that's concerned. And that's just in the U.S. When you take a look at the U.K., the numbers are even more. TikTok at 102 minutes per day compared to 53 minutes on YouTube on average. And even in light of YouTube Shorts, which, as you know, YouTube Shorts was really created to compete directly with TikTok, kids, still prefer the TikTok product as far as that's concerned. And TikTok, we also know that TikTok has increased their video length to 10 minutes. That just happened this year, right? It started out as being this short video platform. Now it's broadened out to 10 minutes. I have to imagine that average watch time will continue to increase as it has from 2020 to 2021 with that change. You've got 11 to 17 seconds on average in 2020. In 2021, 21 to 34 seconds. And as those video lengths increase, as people get more used to seeing longer form video on TikTok, and especially the younger generations who are really investing themselves in the TikTok platform over YouTube, I think more and more TikTok becomes a replacement for those YouTube habits. And so that's just one of the reports. Before I get into the other one, I don't know, I want to check in with you, Micah. Do you have any thoughts on that? Where are you at?
So I will say I'm a weirdo because I can't represent in many cases my generation, because a lot of the folks in my generation are very into YouTube. And I think that what happened to me was, one, I just am an old soul. But also, in a minute, I'll talk about how I'm also a young soul, a bit of an old soul. So YouTube was not a huge thing for me, although I did have a YouTube show back in the day. Mm-hmm. But I didn't watch a lot of YouTube. And then two, I worked in journalism for years, and in particular, I worked in video journalism. And so I am not a big video watcher, because it's like seeing how the sausage gets made and then you get kind of tired of it. Yeah. I prefer to read things if I can, or listen to things. And so I'm not a big, like, when I want to learn new things and I have to use YouTube, I almost always have it at 2x. And the whole time I'm kind of annoyed that I can't just have a transcript that actually, you know, is the proper text of what's on screen.
You just read through it at your own speed.
Yeah.
Or yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But at the same time, Young Soul comes into play when it comes to TikTok, because I don't do it every day. I don't even do it every week necessarily. But, once every couple of weeks, I will open up TikTok and just have fun watching video after video after video. And talk about the algorithm, whatever. But I love my TikTok stream is like adorable dogs doing things, birds dancing to music, which is hilarious to me. Occasionally a recipe comes up, beautiful singers singing beautifully, mm-hmm. and funny moments that are like it is my humor and my comedy. I don't ever see videos of like kids falling down or you know, adults wiping out. None of that stuff is funny to me. It's like the comedy that's there is the comedy that I like. And so there's something to be said for that. And, you know, anecdotally, just the other day, I had a friend mention on YouTube that their algorithm got messed up somehow because they started seeing videos of like people who own lizards, like shedding those lizards. They were, you know, going in and you know, that's for people who like lizards, that's probably an enjoyable thing to watch.
Right, right.
Or for people who were really into that. But for her, she's like, I don't ever want to see that ever, not once. And that's happened to me before on YouTube where I really like watching chiropractic technique at work and hearing people talk about their stories and the pains that they experience and then seeing a chiropractor do the things that a chiropractor does and you know the response that comes out of that. But by watching those videos, it started to lead down this weird path that I had no interest in going.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, this knows nothing about me, but I have not really had that with TikTok. So I think that I am not surprised that the trendy nature of TikTok is what pulls in the kids. But then also what seems to be a better job of recommending videos that a person actually wants to see.
No question.
Helps. And then increasingly, there is something to be said for humanity's attention span and the shortening of that. So all of those things come together to where none of this is a surprise to me.
Yeah, yeah, not a surprise, and I totally agree. The algorithm that is working. I mean, it's what TikTok continues to get praised for time and time again. I think everybody agrees there is something about what TikTok is doing in truly knowing what you as a user, after a short amount of time using it, actually want to see going forward. They nail it, and YouTube has many times not nailed it, and sometimes felt very random. And I don't feel that randomness when I use TikTok, so I totally get it. So it's almost like TikTok understands you as a user more, and you know the younger generation users who are using TikTok become more used to the platform getting it right. And so why would they turn anywhere else, you know? And it's just us older legacy users that maybe get left behind in the dust because that's just what I've always used. So anyway, so that's the first story. The second story, also on TechCrunch, has to do not with video but with search. And Google, and this was about Google itself admitting that TikTok is actually taking away its search and its maps volume as well, which... When I've thought of, like, you know, what is the potential of TikTok, I always think of it in terms of, like, does it replace YouTube or does it, you know, does it outlast, like, YouTube Shorts or whatever Facebook or Instagram has? You know, there's those, like, direct comparisons. But what Google's saying here is 40% of Gen Z actually prefers searching TikTok, and actually Instagram is another one that they called out, over Google's own search and map products. And according to Google SVP, and I'm probably going to get his name wrong, so I apologize, Prabhakar Raghavan, he said during a conference, he said something like almost 40% of young people, when they're looking for a place for lunch, they don't go to Google Maps or search. They go to TikTok or Instagram. And, you know, Google, of course, in light of this, is attempting to make changes to make its search product more appealing to younger users, because that's what they do when things like this happen. They're like, oh, we've got to get the kids. How do we change our search products to appeal to the kids? But I think reading these two in tandem just really kind of reminded me that, like, the things that we may take for granted, that Facebook will be around forever and it will always be dominant because it has all the users, you know, that Google's search has been so dominant for decades now, and that's never going to change because how could anyone beat Google search? I think it just goes to show the power of a younger generation coming in, making discoveries on their own. And we tend to think, or, you know, kind of the tech press and people who are fans of technology tend to think at times that these things are immovable. And mm-hmm. I think what this shows is that, no, you know, given a long enough time span, there will be another one. And it might not come from where you think it's going to come. If you know, I don't know what 10 years down the line TikTok's going to be doing. But, you know, 10 years ago, I wasn't entirely certain that Facebook was going to be getting into the metaverse and VR and everything like that either. So it's just interesting to me to see how these things start and then what they evolve into, and to think about a world in a world, you know, 10 years from now where, you know, is TikTok the next search engine? I don't know, but it could be. As ridiculous as that might seem right now, it very well could be, depending on how these younger generations are like invested and all in on them.
Yeah. I guess we shall see where it goes, but I do think that, yeah, what you've pointed out there, that it's not this, you know, steadfast and true situation where nothing will change.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, if there's one thing that's that stays the same, is the fact that change is constant. So, whatever that quote is.
Yeah, whatever. however that quote goes,
that's basically
that. Probably on a TikTok somewhere.
Yes, well, you know, fellow kids. All right, coming up, your story of the week, which has to do with the Uber files. Dun dun dun. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by ClickUp. Imagine, just imagine, it's hard for me to imagine because I definitely don't feel this way right now, but imagine having one extra day every week. All of that extra time, right? More time to cook healthy meals, more time to work on that novel, binging some good reality TV. What is it like to sit down and watch TV? I don't even know lately. That's my life. For me, I'd be writing some sick tunes and recording them with my fancy new MacBook Pro. That's what I'd be doing if I had an extra day. But now all of this is possible with ClickUp. It's the productivity platform that's going to save you one day a week on work, guaranteed. ClickUp actually began with the premise that productivity was broken. There were too many tools to keep track of, too many things in entirely separate ecosystems, all these different places you have to go in order to do the things you need to do. There had to be a more productive way to get through the daily hustle. And ClickUp is the one tool to house all your tasks, all your projects, your many docs, your goals, your spreadsheets, and more. I mean, they're all in all these different places. How do you kind of unify? Well, ClickUp is built for teams from just you to more than 1,000. I mean, use your imagination. It's packed with features and customization options that no other productivity tool has. So you can actually work the way that you work best. And whether you're in project management, or maybe you're in engineering, as a lot of folks who watch the show are, sales, marketing, HR, whatever it is, ClickUp has easy-to-use solutions that create a more efficient work environment. You can actually join more than 800,000 highly productive teams using ClickUp, and you can do that today. Make sure and use code TNW. You do that, you're going to get 15% off ClickUp's massive unlimited plan for a full year, meaning you can start reclaiming your time for under $5 a month. And you can sign up today at ClickUp.com and make sure, like I said, to use that code TNW. Do hurry. This offer ends soon. And we thank ClickUp. It's good to have you all on board. Thank you for sponsoring this episode of Tech News Weekly. All right, Micah, over to you.
Yes, this is a wild set of stories called the Uber files that came out on July 11th. So Monday, as we are recording the show, back on Monday. And this is a series of, well, it's a write-up about a series of files, 124,000 documents that were leaked to The Guardian. Ooh. Regarding how Uber did quite a few things that are not exactly legal in many ways.
Are we surprised?
No, not at all. Not at all. So again, more than 124,000 documents, and these files reveal that there were attempts by Uber to lobby Joe Biden, Olaf Scholz, and George Osborne. Emmanuel Macron, who was at the time not yet the president of France, but is now the president of France, allegedly aided Uber in lobbying in France. And that was according to texts that they saw, because along with it just being documentation, like emails and stuff like that, it was also WhatsApp messages and iMessages. So all of that together was shown. And then also there was information about what Uber called a kill switch, which was a way for Uber to erase data on its servers in order to circumvent raids by police if police were seeking to view data at the company.
Yeah, that doesn't sound good.
Yeah, a kill switch.
Not a good
I'm all about data privacy protection in terms of if a police officer or a body of law comes and they want like information on one particular individual or, you know, that kind of thing is a whole different ball game versus if the company itself is accused of doing something and they are then erasing all of the data to make sure that they can't be proven that they're doing something. That's a different kind of thing.
Yeah, that is.
You may remember a long, long time ago, and we're showing the photo on the stream if you're watching, that French taxi drivers were very upset about Uber coming to France, and they actually protested. And the protests got a little violent. There was a lot going on, and there was one situation where. Let me find it now. Now I've lost it. Here we go. So, at the time, Kalanick, Travis Kalanick, who was the CEO and the founder of, Uber. They said different people, executives said, "Hey, look, it's really not a good idea to encourage Uber drivers to go to France, or if they are in France already, to protest as part of this, because it puts them at risk. Things could get violent, and it's not a good idea because the taxi industry is very angry right now. So maybe don't do this." And Kalanick responded, quote, "I think it's worth it." And then here's the other quote, "Violence guarantees success," is what Kalanick said. So this is interesting, too. Kalanick's spokesperson responded and said, "Kalanick never suggested that Uber should take advantage of violence at the expense of driver safety, and any suggestion he was involved in such activity would be completely false." So somehow trying to say that the evidence to the contrary is not real is what the spokesperson is saying. It goes on. I mean, this is a huge trove of data and a huge article kind of detailing what they discovered. And in fact, The Guardian worked with several other groups as part of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. And so the ICIJ was at the root of this. That's how they shared data with other media outlets, 40 other media outlets and 180 journalists at Le Monde, Washington Post, the BBC, and more. And those outlets are also going to be publishing pieces related to the Uber files after they've, climbed through all of this data and figured different things out. At one point, Kalanick was set to meet with President Biden, who at the time was Vice President Joe Biden. And I guess he was waiting for Biden, who was late due to other things. And Travis Kalanick texted, "I'm at the Intercontinental waiting for Biden, ... who is late. I've had my people let him know that every minute late he is one less minute he will have with me." So the guy definitely, valued his time. We'll just say that, but was working to try and get Biden on board. And one other quote from this, according to The Guardian, after meeting Kalanick, Biden appears to have amended his prepared speech at Davos to refer to a CEO whose company would give millions of workers, quote, freedom to work as many hours as they wish, manage their own lives as they wish. So an interesting situation there where it seems like whatever conversation did happen resulted in mention of Uber in passing at this speech that Biden was giving. One or a couple of other things, Uber executives appeared to be very aware of the fact that a lot of what they were doing was not legal, was not sort of following the law. You may remember that when Uber was first kind of getting started and started to take off, they were trying to get into other countries as quickly as they possibly could. And in getting into other countries, it often resulted in kind of, what is that called? It's seek forgiveness later, act and then seek forgiveness later.
Yeah, right.
That whole idea.
Ask for forgiveness, not permission.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
I got that one right today, at least. Yeah. Ding, 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 ding. So that appears to be the situation. And the executives who, you know, perhaps in years past have sort of pretended like, oh, we didn't know that this seemed to be on board because many of them, one executive joked that the group had become pirates. And another one said used an expletive to say, we're just bleeping illegal, just straight up said, we are just illegal. And so there were lots of jokes amongst the executives about how they weren't really following the laws, regulations, etc., and that, you know, they continued to move fast regardless of that. One of the most, I think, interesting aspects of this is that the person who appears to be the leaker of this, this person has come forward and said, I am the leaker. It's just not clear to me if that has been confirmed, but The Guardian, you know, didn't make any hedging on that when they said so. Uber's former chief lobbyist in Europe. So this is Mark McGann, who was the lobbyist for Europe, for the Middle East and for Africa. And McGann came forward and said, I'm the one who leaked the data. And said, quote, it is my duty to speak up and help governments and parliamentarians right some fundamental wrongs. Morally, I had no choice in the matter. So 2013 to 2017, 83,000 emails, some iMessages and WhatsApp messages, and lots of, as they say, unvarnished conversations. Uber, for its part, in response to the Uber files, said, quote, we have not and will not make excuses for past behavior that is clearly not in line with our present values. Instead, we ask the public to judge us by what we've done over the last 5 years and what we will do in the years to come. So, I can kind of guess your thoughts on this, but I would like to hear just your reaction at the very least.
I mean, I'm not surprised at all. I think that that statement right there, you know, kind of says it all, where they realize, who is it, Rosh Hashari? Why am I blanking on the current CEO's name?
Crud, yeah. Keep going, I'll find it.
Yeah, I mean, the current, it's yeah, I'm blanking, but the current leadership at Uber is, I mean, at least from the outside looking in, very different, clearly different. Travis Kalanick was poison, in my opinion. He was just incredibly, he was just horrible in a lot of ways, you know, misogynistic, implemented a lot of things that were just incredibly inappropriate, drove the staff to insane levels of overwork, you know, at times pitting them against each other and not really caring about it as long as the final product was Uber wins. You know what I mean? It was just from, you know, toxic culture all around. So I'm not surprised at any of this. I don't know how much you hold a company like this accountable for things that happened under that kind of leadership that was 5+ years ago. I mean, I speak like, what I mean by that is, like, I actually don't know the law. Like, how accountable is the Uber of today when, you know, some of these decisions were tied to Travis Kalanick, who isn't there anymore? Does that fall on Kalanick? Does that fall on Uber? If, you know, if there are any charges that follow as a result of some of this reporting, I'm not sure. But yeah, in my opinion, it was a great day when Kalanick was no longer CEO at Uber. I still, at the time, I remember just being like, I'm not riding an Uber, you know, I'm going to take a Lyft, even though Lyft was harder to ride. You know, it was not nearly as ubiquitous, in any of the places that I was doing rideshare, but I kind of refused. And I've used Uber since that he's been gone, and I've have a little bit more of an improved taste in my mouth as far as the company is concerned and the culture improvements and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, as far as these reports are concerned, I'm totally not surprised at all. This sounds pretty much in line with exactly what I would expect.
I agree wholeheartedly. None of this is shocking to me. Yeah. The only thing that's shocking is the detail, and that's why it's well worth. Sure. We'll include a link, of course. It's well worth heading to the Guardian's piece. It's kind of hard to find if you just type in Uber Files The Guardian, because they've got like a page that has all the breakout articles. So I've got the direct link to the original reporting that then has links out to other things, and that way you can see what it's all about. Just because it's kind of wild what is available in there. And I do wonder how this moves forward in terms of what the company what can be done. For something that's already been done.
totally we shall see on another episode, because at this point we've reached the end of this episode, so we'll get back to you on that. But Tech News Weekly publishes every Thursday at twit.tv/TNW. You can go to that show page and subscribe in the many ways, the many different feeds, and you know, a YouTube link. We don't have a TikTok live link yet. Does TikTok even have a live component? I don't know that it does.
I think it does.
Live streaming.
Yeah.
Twitch.
Yeah, because I'm thinking about some of the crafters will occasionally be live, and they're like throwing pots and stuff.
So. Yeah. Well, I don't believe that Twit is there yet, but hey, you never know.
Not in live streaming. maybe I'll have to set up a stream next time.
Yeah.
That just plays on TikTok.
But twit.tv/TNW for everything we do have. Check it out there.
And if you'd like to get all of our shows ad-free, well, we've got a way for you to do that. You can check out Club Twit for $7 a month or $84 a year. You can join Club Twit. What does that get you? Well, it gets you every single show ad-free, which is super awesome. But it also gets you access to the Twit Plus bonus feed that has extra content you won't find anywhere else. That is behind the scenes, before the show, after the show, and some special bits that get added there, as well as access to the members-only Discord server. That's the place where you can go to chat with your fellow Club Twit members, and also those of us here at Twit. All of that available, twit.tv/clubtwit for $7 a month, and access to shows that are exclusive to Club Twit, including my new show, which the second episode publishes today, Hands on Mac. So if you want to check that out, well, join the club. I should also mention that there is another way for you to get that show. You can go to twit.tv/clubtwit, the same place that you go, $7 a month, and you can get the Hands on Mac only plan for $2.99 a month. You'll get access to my show without any of the extra stuff. You don't have to worry about it. It's just the Hands on Mac single show plan. That and this show are available as well as part of the Apple Podcast subscription for $2.99 a month. You'll get the audio feed completely ad-free. You just head into Apple Podcasts, you type in Tech News Weekly, and you can tap to subscribe on the audio feed for $2.99 with zero ads. So Hands on Mac.
Love it.
And Tech News Weekly, no ads, and all of the other good stuff as part of Club Twit. If you want to follow me online, I'm at Micah Sargent on many a social media network, or you can head to chihuahua.coffee. That's chihuahua.coffee, where I've got links to the places I'm most active online. Later today, if you're a Club Twit member or a subscriber, you can check out Hands on Mac. Saturday, I will be hosting Leo Laporte's Tech Guy on my own. So this will be my first time doing the radio show
on my own.
Tune in on Saturday, starting at 11 a.m. Super excited, looking forward to that. And then on Tuesdays, iOS Today, which I record with my co-host Rosemary Orchard, where we talk all things iOS, tvOS, HomePodOS, etc., etc. And then Jason, you and I are going to be on a lot of shows next week. Tell us about those and your shows.
Well, that's true. I'm happy you mentioned that, because I almost forgot to mention it here. But Leo and Lisa will be away on the Twit Cruise, which means that Micah and I will be filling in for him while he's gone. I'm going to be doing This Week in Google. I'm going to be doing Security Now. You're going to be doing Mac Break Weekly, right? Any other shows that you're dropping in on?
Mac Break Weekly, well, and then Windows
Tech
Weekly.
And then Tech Guy, of course.
I don't know if you already might have mentioned Windows Weekly.
No.
Might have missed that.
That one as well. So yeah, you're going to see a lot of us next week. And then, of course, I also do All About Android, twit.tv/AAA every Tuesday. So you will get your fix of us next week. Be sure and check that out. I'm at Jason Howell on Twitter. If you want to find me on the socials, you can find me there. Thanks to John Ashley for helping out here in the studio each and every week and for his ever-evolving role on the show. Really appreciate everything that you do. Also, thanks to Burke. For getting us set up and moving over TVs in the studio when I needed it a little bit earlier. And thanks to you for watching and listening. We will see you all next time on Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Did you spend a lot of money on your brand new smartphone and then you look at the pictures on Facebook and Instagram and you're like, what in the world happened to that photo? Yes. You have. I know. It happens to all of us. Well, you need to check out my show, Hands-On Photography, where I'm going to walk you through simple tips and tricks that are going to help make you get the most out of your smartphone camera or your DSLR or mirrorless, whatever you have. And those shots are going to look so much better. I promise you. So make sure you're tuning in to twit.tv/hop for Hands-On Photography to find out more.